We want to welcome our speakers, Irv Nelson and Mark Behrens, to speak before our Las Vegas chapter today. They're going to be talking about judicial activism in the Nevada judiciary. As those of you who follow our legislature, last session there was a lot of proposed changes to Nevada law in a lot of respects, and some of it became law, some of it didn't, and we'll find out a lot more today how Nevada is viewed in the United States and what specific things are potentially going to come forward in the next legislature. This is sponsored by the Federalist Society. Federalist Society is a national organization of conservative and libertarian lawyers. There's information about the group on your table for those of you who are not as familiar with the group as others. They have lawyers chapters like this all over the United States. They have student chapters all over the United States in the law schools. It's a group founded after decades of liberal orthodoxy being the primary philosophy that was taught and preached in law schools to students, and that became part of the jurisprudence of the country. There's really a need to have another voice, another perspective, and this organization has grown and flourished over the decades, and it's a wonderful group to be with. They're having a conference on Saturday at the Reagan Library for the Western United States, and we'll have, if you were to go to it, a wonderful opportunity to hear discussions on federalism with Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal judges, law professors, scholars, and that's what the Federalist Society brings, is a real debate and perspective on jurisprudence. We're happy that Lisa Zell from the Washington, D.C. office of the Federalist Society is with us in a rare Las Vegas appearance. Lisa, how many lawyers' chapters are there in the United States that you oversee?
We have about 80 lawyers' chapters.
So 80. That's a lot of administration, and that's a lot more than there used to be, so it's a really growing group. We're happy to present the discussion in Nevada judiciary today. First joining us from Washington, D.C., so I guess he managed to get out somehow, is Mark Behrens, a partner at Shook, Hardy & Bacon, who co-chairs its public policy group. Mark's been listed as one of Washington, D.C.'s top lawyers by Washingtonian Magazine. He's a leading product liability attorney. He's co-authored over 150 amicus briefs on behalf of national, state, business, and civil justice organizations. He's argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, many federal appellate courts and state courts. He's testified before state legislatures. He's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1987. As was I, very coincidental. And all those years I thought I was the only conservative who ever attended the University of Wisconsin. But there's two of us. Got his law degree from Vanderbilt University.
There's apparently another badger.
Oh, okay. Three. Irv Nelson is a member of the Nevada State Assembly and an attorney who works at the Cram Valdez Brigham & Nelson firm. And he is co-chair of the Assembly Judiciary Committee. Is that right? Vice chair? Vice chairman of the Assembly Judiciary Committee. He knows more than anybody about what has happened in terms of tort reform legislation and other changes to our laws that were proposed, some of which were enacted, and what's coming down the pipe. We look forward to hearing from Irv Nelson and Mark Behrens. Welcome them to our Las Vegas chat. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I want to thank Lisa for inviting me here from the Nationals chapter, and for Matt, and really just when you have a minute today on your way out, give him a special thank you. Matt has done a lot of work to bring this together, and terrific work, and working with Representative Nelson to come. I'm just so happy to be here. With 80 chapters, I understand Lisa has a lot of places to go, but we ought to try to find a way to get here more often.
This is a great
place. I actually found out, I told my parents I was coming here yesterday, and they told me my brother is here. He's staying at the Venetian for another conference. I probably won't even get to see him on this trip, but what an amazing coincidence. I'm very glad to be here today, and I was trying to think of what my perspective could be, how I can offer I'm going to give you a national perspective today on what folks outside Nevada are looking. I know if you say Nevada, everybody in Nevada, the East Coast says Nevada. I've learned to say it right here. But what is the perception of Nevada for people elsewhere in the country? And I'll give you a snapshot about that. These are national perspectives. I'm going to talk a little bit about a survey that recently came out from the United States Chamber of Commerce Institute for Legal Reform, and then the American Tort Reform Foundation, which is part of the American Tort Reform Association, which has its annual Judicial Hellholes Report. We'll talk a little bit about that, and then some other studies that have come out, and then just briefly talk about what Nevada can do to improve the image of the judiciary. That image across the country is one that, frankly, Nevada has some problems. It's not in the bottom of the country. It's not down where Mississippi's been, where West Virginia's been, Louisiana, places that most people associate with a biased judiciary. But it's not doing that great either. So in the U.S. Chamber's survey, they looked at over 1,200 in-house general counsel, senior litigators, and attorneys to companies with at least $100 million in annual revenue. So they're looking at top people in the legal departments that manage litigation at very large companies. And one thing is, you wouldn't be too surprised to find out, is that 75% of these people believe that a state's legal climate is an important factor in deciding where they're going to locate operations and expand business. We've seen a great example of that in Texas. Texas, 15 years ago, was a terrible place to do business. They had a judiciary that was very biased, very unfair towards business defendants in particular. And it was hurting the state's ability to raise their economy. President Bush came in, and that changed. And then with Governor Perry, Texas now leads the nation in legal reforms. It's a very business-friendly state. Legal reform is just one part of the things, package that's made Texas job-friendly. They have a regulatory environment that's friendly, a tax environment that's friendly, right-to-work laws. There's a number of things that Texas has done, but tort reform was an important part of sending a message to employers. And I think that the message sent is as important as the substance. And the message is that we are a state in Texas, this is the message they send, we are a state that welcomes job creators. We want people that are going to come in and open and expand operations in this state. And you, over the last decade or so, you've seen just an enormous number of companies that are relocating, particularly from California, from high-cost, high-litigation, high-regulation states into Texas. And tort reform is part of the reasons that they're doing that. And the Chamber survey backs that up. Well, in looking at this survey, Nevada is ranked 35th in terms of how general counsels around the country perceive the overall fairness of the state's legal climate. So a little less than below average. I guess it would be like a D, if not an F, if that makes you feel better. But there's certainly room to improve. And the survey is very surgical, too. And I was looking at it this morning, and they break it down. So they have the overall fairness number. But then they have specifics in the survey to look at how is the state doing in particular areas. There are some where the state is doing very well, and the judiciary is doing well here. Discovery, for instance. Nevada is ranked 25th in how the judiciary is perceived to be dealing with discovery issues. It is 25th as well in expert evidence and how the state is dealing with expert evidence. So the state is doing average in those areas. But when it comes to the perceived impartiality of the judiciary, the state drops to 38. When you look at the perceived competence of the judiciary, it's 38. And that's pulling the sector down. And then on damages, the state ranks 41st. I know that there's a cap on non-economic damages and medical liability cases that the Supreme Court upheld in line with the majority of other states. But these are areas when the state is looking at, okay, where, what is holding down our numbers? What is affecting the perception of the fairness of the state's legal climate? It goes to perceived bias in the judiciary and the damages issues. And I think that you see that too. I looked over, the American Tort Reform Association publishes its annual judicial hellholes report. And they always have this, well, this one has got pictures of the Supreme Court. A lot of them have pictures of judges holding gavels and fire and things like that. It's sensationalistic, yes, but it also helps give a picture of what states are being perceived as having an unfair or biased legal climate. And I pulled up on their website, they've got all of the judicial health reports going back the last decade on there. And I went back and looked at the report since 2007. Clark County, in particular, has been on the Hellholes Report 4 times in the last decade, and 3 times on what they call the watch list. Now, the watch list is sort of, you can either get there if you are a state that has been a hellhole and is adopting reforms and moving in the right direction. Philadelphia, for example. Philadelphia, about 3 years ago, was the number one judicial hell in the country because they actually had judges that would go to these for-profit seminars around the country. They had a judge who managed their complex litigation, asbestos cases in particular, who would go to these for-profit conferences around the United States, go to Los Angeles, go to San Francisco, and say, we want you to come to Philadelphia and bring your cases. We love it when the lawyers come here and they stay in our hotels and they eat at our restaurants. That's good for the local. Lawsuits are good for the local economy. And as you would imagine, a judge that has the philosophy that litigation is an economic development tool is going to issue rulings that are going to sort of incentivize that behavior. And that's what landed Philadelphia, those rulings landed Philadelphia on the Hellholes list. Well, they had a more fair judge who came in a couple years ago who said, you know, this is embarrassing. Philadelphia has a rich and long-standing bar and bench that has been respected. And this judge said, that's not the kind of thing. Judges should not be going around the country advertising that we want your cases. That's not the kind of thing that judges are supposed to be doing. And it certainly doesn't reflect impartiality on the bench. And so they have a new judge, and he really almost immediately instituted reforms to clean up some of this and put restrictions on out-of-state cases coming in to make sure that the cases coming into Philadelphia actually had a legitimate business of being there. And they got off. So they moved down to the watch list. So the watch list can be for people that are moving towards and then move their way off that. And then it can also be for states or places, like if you're 35th on the chamber survey, and they go down a little bit more, if there are more perceived unfairness, that's how you land. You go from the watch list up to the full health list. And Clark County in particular has sort of bounced back and forth over the last decade. But when you look at the jurisdictions in the United States, there's probably only a half a dozen that are consistently on this list. And it's not a place that you want to go because it's not a place where job creators are going to look to want to create jobs, right? If you are a general counsel of a company, you have the whole United States to decide where you're going to expand operations. Do you really want to expand your operations in a place called the judicial hellhole? No, it's not the kind of thing that we want. And importantly, the judicial hellholes list is not a jury bashing exercise at all. It's talking about the fairness of the judges. Because more often than not, even when there are what would seem to be crazy cases or outrageous verdicts, more often than not, the jury is actually making a rational decision based on the evidence that they were allowed to hear. Those things usually come because of rulings from judges that are displaying a particular bias. And, you know, here it's not just these national surveys. I was looking at what's been written about the state's legal climate here in Nevada, particularly here in Las Vegas. So I found an article, April 2013, from the Las Vegas Review Journal. Las Vegas is the undisputed jackpot justice capital of the world. And then they go on to say, you don't get a fair shake in the Nevada justice system, not even close. Rest assured, our casinos offer fair play, but the courts are rigged. Now, that's not me saying this. This is an editorial from the Las Vegas Review Journal. But then they talk about that. And, you know, one thing I noticed in the Hellholes reports and in this, a lot of these come out of really a tragic situation that you all are familiar with the medical clinic that had given out tainted syringes, contaminated syringes, and infected people with hepatitis. And a lot of these outrageously large awards have come out of that. But again, this goes to the perceived appropriateness of what the judges have said. So in this article, they talk about these big awards. But then they say the jurors are obligated to base their decision only on what they hear in the courtroom. And in these cases, as with cases against drug companies, plaintiff-friendly judges effectively made it impossible for the business to defend itself. They're talking about Teva Pharmaceuticals, which made the propofol that was used in there. One judge, I won't go into their names, but one judge didn't allow jurors, for example, to hear evidence that the doctor and his staff engaged in horrific misconduct and ignored FDA-approved warnings on medicine vials against their reuse, and that hepatitis C could be spread in other ways. Juries also weren't told that other juries had determined the drug companies were at fault when they were suing them. So, again, this kind of is just another illustration of now a local paper reflecting the same kind of concerns that you hear from the 1,200 general counsel and senior litigators that are surveyed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Institute for Legal Reform. And that the many, many people that are active members across the country, when they're asked, what are the places in the United States that you perceive you're not getting a fair trial? Clark County in particular always ends up on that list. And you don't hear businesses saying, we want a system that favors us. What you hear is, we want a system that's fair to all. And people believe here that they're not getting that. And again, and it also is apparently something that's shared among members of the local bar, this concern about the fairness of the judiciary. So in one of the Hellholes reports I found, this is from 2008, they talk about then the president of the state bar in Nevada took the first critical step towards recovery in August 2008 when he acknowledged with a column that Clark County has a judicial hellholes problem. This is the president of the Nevada State Bar. He said, the last few years there have been articles in the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times regarding the improper and corrupting influence of campaign contributions in Nevada. The American Tort Reform Foundation ranking America's most unfair jurisdictions in its judicial hellholes publication listed Clark County for the first time in 2007, indicating that the decks appear to be stacked in favor of local lawyers who reportedly pay to play in the county's courts. The State Bar President's response was, the public must believe that the judiciary is fair and free from improper influence. This also talks about a May 2008 anonymous online survey of almost 800 Clark County attorneys. Many of them said that certain judges favor lawyers or litigants involved in cases they decide. In fact, every jurist was perceived by at least a few lawyers to be biased in some fashion, with personal bias regarding individuals being alleged more often than any other bias. And so, again, these are polls of you all and your colleagues, local lawyers, saying, we don't think the system is fair. We think that there is a bias. And so, I live in a town where reality is not necessarily reality, but perception is reality. And that's true here. I'm not litigating in Clark County. I can't tell you from personal experience. But when I see a poll of 1,200 general counsels and senior litigators say that there's a problem, when ATRA polls all of its members, which include nonprofits, it's not just big companies, they have small companies, they have nonprofits, school boards, things like that, and then they say a problem. When you hear the Nevada State Bar president, right, that there's a problem. And then a poll of the people who actually appear before the courts say that there's a problem. I think we could all conclude that there's a problem here. It may not rise to the level of some other states, but there's a lot of room for improvement to help improve the perception of justice here in the state and to improve the state's legal climate and make it a place that employers want to come. Well, so what are some things you can do about this? Now, you know, Matt made some important remarks. The Federalist Society is not a political organization. Yeah, there are members who are political people, but it's not like the ABA where we sit down or the members sit down and vote to end nuclear weapons or end world hunger or something like that. It's a debating society, and I'm here to give you some of my own views. These aren't the organization's views, but just some of my own views on what are some solutions. When you have a place that sort of year after year has this judicial bias problem, what are some things that can be done? One of the things that other states do is look to, well, how are we picking the judges? How are people getting there? Maybe it's the process that is resulting in this perception of bias. And, you know, here the state, I understand, has nonpartisan elections, so you know that it's not occurring through an overt party-related bias. But you do see it coming out in the campaign contributions. One of the stories that's in here, again, talking about these protocol cases, notes that in one of the judges, it was randomly assigned one of the cases that effectively stripped the defendant of its business, of its defenses. It said, financial records show that just months before this random case assignment, this judge's re-election campaign received $40,000 from the plaintiff's lawyer and others at his firm. Now, maybe other people gave, I'm sure other people gave as well, and I'm not saying that because somebody gave $40,000, that's the reason why this judge effectively stripped the defendant of its defenses. But the public perception, again, whether the reality is a reality, doesn't necessarily matter. The perception of the public is going to be that something's going on here, that this is not the way justice should be dispensed in this country. And so one of the ways that you can deal with that is get rid of the elections. So in the last couple of years, there have been efforts in other states to do just that. Kansas and Tennessee in the last 2 years or so have moved away from elected judges and appointed judges to, or bar-appointed judges to having a federal model where the governor can decide who wins. They've decided we're going to get either the bar associations or money out of judicial campaigns. So that's one of the things you can think about doing is change the way the judges are selected here. And again, recent examples, other states are doing it through a federal model. Other states have something called the Missouri Plan, which we've seen in Missouri has produced incredibly biased results that are just as biased, if not more so, than here, because the nominating commission gets captured by plaintiff's bar. And so if ever the state were to go with that route, it'd be very careful to look to make sure the commission is not biased. But look at how you elect judges here in the state. Legislative reforms, the representative's going to talk about that. When you're 41st in the country in the perception of the fairness of damages in the state, you can tackle that. When the state, I remember years ago when the state had a problem with people, the emergency rooms, people being turned down in emergency rooms and things like that, emergency rooms closing because of medical liability crisis, that the state dealt with that, the voters dealt with that by capping non-economic damages in medical cases. So there is a mechanism to deal with that. It's called legislative reform, and Representative can talk about that. And then the other is the court of public opinion. It's very important here. When there are instances of perceived bias or abuses, let people know about that. I think that sunlight is a great disinfectant, and we need transparency in our legal system. I found that in the Hells report that, as you might not be too surprised, judges often don't like to be named a judicial hell. And some of them may not even know that they're rulings. You know, they may issue rulings in individual cases And they're not even thinking, what is the bigger picture when you put all these pieces together? They're just saying, I'm going to do what's fair in this case, I'm going to do what's fair in this case, and they're not stepping back to realize, okay, but when you look at all the rulings in all these cases, they're all coming out on one side. And so let people know about that, and write about it, write op-eds, and be happy to. Well, I guess we're going to go to Herb, and then we'll answer any questions after. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Nice to see you all today. I don't usually talk like this. I'm kind of losing my voice right now, so hopefully you understand me. This is not going to be a political talk, hopefully. This is only going to be a legal talk. I'm going to discuss some of the bills that were proposed in the last legislative session. I'm not even going to tell you who sponsored them or how I voted. Senator Harris is here. She sponsored some good ones, but I'm not even going to tell you which ones they are. we have tried, when I say we, the state has tried a number of times to change how judges are elected. There have been a number of bills that have passed the legislature. The problem is, it's a constitutional amendment to do that. And the voters have not seen fit yet to vote that in. I had a discussion at the start of the session in February last year with James Hardesty, who's our Chief Justice, about it again. And he and I even went through a bill together. And we decided that it was too soon to do it again. So perhaps that will be reintroduced in the 2017 legislative session. There are a number of us who agree that we have a bad system for blind judges and we need to get a better one. The one we were looking at was kind of a hybrid of the Missouri plan. And again, the good news is, though, the state had tried a number of times to get an intermediate court of appeals, as you all know. And the voters would not vote for that either. This time they did. In 2014, the voters finally agreed, so now we finally have a mid-level court of appeals. So we are making progress, and things will happen. And I've got, on a PowerPoint, probably much more than we need to go through. I'll just fly through these real quickly. If you would like a copy of the PowerPoint, give me a business card, and I will email it to you. These are a few of the things that happened in the last session. As you all know, in Nevada, we only meet every other year for 4 months, 120 days. There's a funny story. It used to be they met for 60 days every 2 years, and Mark Twain visited the legislative session once and said, I think you should meet for 2 days every 60 years. But now we're up to 120 days. Okay, Assembly Bill 7, like I said, I'll go through these real quickly. And I'm giving you not only the bills that passed, but some that didn't pass, because part of my assignment was to try to think about what might happen in the next legislative session. And of course that depends on who's elected, but here's a little bit of history. This bill, Assembly 7, as you can see, it failed the deadline. In other words, it did not pass. It would have prevented an uninsured motorist from collecting non-economic damages for pain and suffering in a civil action arising from a traffic accident with an insured at-fault driver. So the public policy behind this was to get everybody to have auto insurance. Lively debate on this. Everybody had their own vote on this. I actually ended up voting against my caucus on it, but it didn't pass. That, who knows, that might come again. Assembly Bill 66 relates to justice courts, and this doesn't really affect us anymore, but I think it's interesting to show the trend that now even in Sparks and Reno, to be a JP, you have to be a licensed attorney. And of course, a lot of people up there didn't like that. The problem is, some of the justices of peace who were not lawyers were ruling on evidentiary motions, and a number of the lawyers thought the JPs didn't know what they were doing. For us in Las Vegas, it increased the jurisdiction of justice courts from 10,000 to 15,000, and it also increased the small claims to 1,000. Okay, 124 was enrolled, that means it passed, the governor signed it. This is criminal, but it's interesting, it raised the minimum age at which a child may be punished from 8 years to 10 years of age, unless the child is charged with murder or certain sexual offenses. Okay, 125, this was a giant bill, as you all know, relates to constructional defects. That sounds like an odd way to say construction defect, but in our statute it's called constructional defects. I won't take the time to go through the whole thing. It changed the way attorney's fees are awarded. They're no longer awarded as part of damages. And it also dealt with indemnification, consolidated insurance programs. It made it so that the plaintiff has to point to a specific location where the damage is. And the defendants have the opportunity to go out and look at it, inspect it, and even agree to a judgment immediately to stop the damages from occurring. And this was a partisan thing that passed. People are always asking me, will it be repealed in the next session? Who knows? That depends on who gets elected. I think, though, that the governor would veto a change, but who knows? I did a little bit with the statutes of limitation and the statutes of repose. And another important point is, second from the bottom here, an association, meaning homeowners association, may not pursue a construction defect claim on behalf of all of its owners unless the claim pertains only to common areas. So they can't band together now and say, we're suing the HOA, we're suing on behalf of all of our homeowners. This is a big change. And also the claimant has to try to make a claim under his or her homeowner's warranty first before the removal. Okay, next, Assembly Bill 195. This bill, this is a long explanation for basically, we changed the way default judgments are, deficiency judgments, I apologize. Deficiency judgments are calculated in commercial cases. This does not affect residential secured loans, it only affects commercial loans. Some of you may remember in 2011, the legislature changed the law and with respect to commercial lending. And the problem is, it made it so that lenders were disincentivized from coming in and purchasing troubled loans at a discount value. Because if they purchased the loans at a discount value, say 50%, that would be all they could recover in their deficiency ticket. So it took away the profit motive. That crisis is for the most part passed. And so this bill kind of put the law back the way it was before 2011. The goal is to get more commercial lending in the state, and hopefully it will. Okay, 267, most of you probably don't care about this, deals with persons under the age of 18. I'm sorry, I skipped. And it deals with the national problem of sentencing people who commit a crime before they're 18 to life without the possibility of parole, if you think that's a problem. And a lot of people do, and so we address that. Next would be 435. Probably won't affect many people in Clark County. Create an additional judicial district. And for some of the rural counties, now when I was growing up, we called them Cal counties, but that's not politically correct anymore, I think. And so now they're rural counties, but kind of making things more efficient there. 129, another one, we'll just fly through this. Who knows what an equine event is? It has to do with horses, very good. And they were having problems where people would get injured at these events, and this was to, this will take us out of the hell hole. Up in some of the rural counties. because you have to prove much more if you get injured in an equine event. If a horse runs over you when you're sitting in the stands, you probably still have a cause of action. Okay, 134, this was a very big bill, very important. And I put up here, in case you're interested, the votes, and you can kind of see the political climate here. This one had really no opposition at all, both between A and the Senate. This limits the amount of a bond in some of these giant, giant cases that you were talking about, where the multi-million dollar verdict. It basically limits the amount that the defendant would have to pay to get a superseding fine on appeal. Of course, there are exceptions. That was very important. 160 relates to civil liability, and this is like in the instance where a trespasser comes onto your property and gets injured, and then of course they'll sue you because they were injured on your property, and this just makes it a little bit higher bar for them to pass to be able to sue you for that. Also, look up at the top. As you know, in some of these big giant buildings, people are going up and jumping off from parachutes or propelling down them and they get injured. So now that's, if you do it in certain cases, that's category E felony, and you're going to have a lot more trouble establishing liability on the hotel. Okay, next is SB, the Senate Bill 161. Regarding product liability actions, as you can see, this was vetoed. It barely passed the Senate 11-9 and passed the Assembly 25-17. This would have prohibited filing or maintenance of a product liability action against a seller who is not the manufacturer of the product. And as you know, what happens in a lot of these cases, the plaintiffs will sue the manufacturer but also the retail seller. And the import behind this bill was, if the seller didn't do anything wrong, particularly if the seller is just taking something that's already packaged from the manufacturer, from a wholesaler, and selling it on the shelves, why should they be liable? It passed the governor veto. Senate Bill 162, motor vehicle personal injury claims. Oh, this is, okay. The rule used to be, in personal injury cases, tort cases involving automobiles, that the plaintiff's lawyer could find out the insurance limits as long as the plaintiff's lawyer also provided the medical records. It was almost a quid pro quo when you would do it quickly. This was a compromise of that bill, and it ended up going back. So that's the background of this thing. And this changes the government, the provision of medical records. It used to be that even prior to discovery, you could call up and say, tell me the limits, so I can, the claims lawyer could say, tell me the limits, the policy limits, so we can figure out what this case is for. And in the personal injury lawyer's minds, it was, if it's only a $25,000 policy, then we're going to tell our client very quickly, you got to settle this thing, let's get out of it. You can't have 15 MRIs and surgeries and things like that. Like I said, the quid pro quo is to provide all the medical records. The defense bar looked at it as, you just want to find out what the limits are, so if it's a big policy, then you're going to jack up the damages by sending them to the chiropractor 30 times, the pain management, and things like that. Basically, this was, I think, a really bad compromise, but it passed away. Okay, 244, contingent legal fee contracts. This is when the state, through the Attorney General, hires lawyers to handle civil actions and pays them pursuant to contingency contract. This just changes it now, since the governor and the Attorney General have to make sure that it's fair, cost effective, and in the public interest. Okay, 292, civil actions involving negligence. This is one we're referring to. The term professional negligence now also includes dental malpractice. And it broadened the definition of provider of health care. Of course, everyone wants to get in on that, the rest homes, the nursing homes, all these different facilities. That's what kind of brought this bill to the forefront. And it clarified that there's a $350,000 cap on non-economic damages, regardless of the number of plaintiffs, defendants, or theories. So if you have one lawsuit, $350,000 is all you're going to get, even if you're suing the doctor, the hospital, everybody else. Clarify that. And it also made it stricter on what you have to provide in the affidavit. In Nevada, as you know, in a medical practice case, from the very start when you file a complaint, you have to have an affidavit from another doctor saying, it looks like to me that there's a reasonable likelihood that, I'm not a PI lawyer, but that the work did not rise to the level of standard of care, level of care in the community. And I had a few more things you had to put in the affidavits. Okay, next is 296. Now, this was another one that was vetoed. This had to do with pleading at the start of the case and not throwing in a giant demand to kind of inflame everybody and to get press. You know, as you know, under the rules of civil procedure, you're supposed to ask for an amount in excess of $10,000. What a number of people were doing, they're saying some very large amount, and this cut back on that. It also set forth conditions under which limits on exemplary or punitive damages do not apply to manufacturer, distributor, or seller of affected products. So this is more product liability litigation. Okay, SB 304 failed the deadline. Okay, this had to do with taxicabs. In the circumstance where the plaintiff is a passenger and does not wear a seatbelt. And, of course, the plaintiff's bar's position was, that's not relevant, that evidence should be excluded. The defense bar's position was, no, that might be the reason they were injured. We need to have that come in. And the bill would have allowed the failure to wear a safety belt as evidence of negligence or as causation or as misuse or abuse of the product. And like I said, this failed the deadline, which means the product ran out of time. Next is SB 444. This is the SLAPP lawsuits. This is a very interesting area of law. I spent days being lobbied by both sides just trying to understand this. It's a technical area of law, and there have been some cases that have come down in California and Washington, and a number of people were afraid we were going to go in the way of California and Washington. This is the type of thing where, let's say, a newspaper reporter writes something negative about a very prominent casino, like Steve Wynn. Not to name names, but that's one of the cases. And so then he immediately sues them for defamation or whatever, and they claim First Amendment rights, and that's what this litigation is about. This changed a few of the deadlines to make a little bit more reasonable, I think, to respond. You're supposed to put on a prima facie case if you're complaining. And okay. 514 was the General Appropriations Act, and the interesting thing about this is the way the law was written before the session was, if an intermediate court were established, then the number of Supreme Court justices would have gone from 7 to 5. This bill changed that, basically because the legislature was convinced that we still needed 7 justices on the Supreme Court because the caseload level, even if we got the intermediate court. Just a couple others, and that's the end of that. There's a couple of others that I just want to mention, then I'll sit down. SB 186 passed, and that basically said that if the state of Nevada, and this is patterned after federal law, if the state of Nevada criminally prosecutes you and they lose, and if you as a defendant can prove that the state's actions were vexatious, frivolous, or in bad faith, then you can get attorney's fees and costs. And like I said, that's following the federal rule. And another, which I think is a very significant piece of litigation that I forgot about and remember this morning, is SB 512, And I won't say who sponsored this, but she's in the room. And she's a state senator. And this bill passed unanimously. And I don't know if Senator Harris is all right if I explain your bill. Okay, I'll try to do it. This has to do with foreclosure mediation. As you all know, we had a giant problem with underwater houses. We still do, but it was really bad 3 or 4 years ago. And so legislation passed a couple sessions ago requiring mediation. So if I'm the homeowner and the lender starts to foreclose against me, if I paid $200 to the Supreme Court, I can opt into the foreclosure mediation program. It stops the lawsuit. The lender has to show up with certain documents like proof of the deed of trust and the promissory note. And the lender has to send someone to the mediation who has authority to not only settle the case, but modify the loan. And I know, Ben, you have 100 of those mediations probably, didn't you? And it was a very good program. The problem was, if you were a homeowner and you're in trouble, unless a foreclosure had started, you couldn't do anything. And so a number of these homeowners were coming to lawyers and other advisors saying, what should I do? And some people were saying, well, you got to quit paying your loan. So that'll ruin my credit. Well, too bad. You can't get into mediation if you don't quit that. This bill, which Senator Harris thought up, and I think is a fantastic bill, changed the law and said, no, the homeowner can initiate mediation. All you have to prove is that you're in some sort of financial straits or there's a possibility that you can get into financial problems through a counseling agency. And then the homeowner can initiate the mediation. I'll tell you a funny story. So it passed the Senate. I'm not trying to butter up Senator Harris, but she came to the Assembly Committee and presented the bill. And about more than half of the people on the Assembly Judiciary Committee said, we want to amend it. And I know she's going, oh, how do you want to amend it? And we all said, we want to be co-sponsors. That's how universal it was. And I think this is really going to help a lot. Okay, that's a short. There were 550 bills that passed, so I've just kind of given you a little highlight, all sorts of them in education and tax, and we'll talk about those for obvious reasons. I agree with what you said. We need to change the perception in Nevada. Many, many lawyers feel the way we choose judges is archaic and biased and fraught with problems. I'll tell you the story that happened to me. In 2014, I had a case before a judge, had a very important motion coming up, and about a week before the motion was going to be heard, I got an email saying, contribute to this judge. I'm sure it was a coincidence, because he probably had someone else handling his emails. So what do you do? When you have a very big motion in front of a judge, are you going to contribute? Are you not going to contribute? Does the judge know who contributes or doesn't? And it puts the lawyers and the judge in a very bad position. I went to my partners and we decided we better contribute. We would have anyway, because I think this judge is an excellent judge, and that was borne out because he actually ruled in my favor. But it looked bad. And so I agree that we need to change that. It's really bad when the judges are raising money primarily for the lawyers who are paying for them. It's just a terrible system. Yeah.
Well, I'm Judge Conrad Hafen, and I preside over a criminal calendar and justice court. And let me give you the flip side to that argument. When I ran 5 years ago, I decided not to take one dime from attorneys at all. Still don't. Okay. My opponent raised $90,000. I spent $2,900, and I beat him by 7 or 8 points. All right. Now, we'll see if that holds true this year because I'm up for re-election. But it was interesting when I would tell people I don't take money from lawyers, they would say, that's nice. Are you crazy?
Right.
And I would get that response from attorneys as well. And I know that a lot of people are saying, well, maybe we should do the appointment process. My thought on that is, if we do the appointment process, we're still going to have the good old boy network, you're still going to get people who are politically in tune or in touch with the right type of people, and those people that don't have those connections will never be given the opportunity to be a judge. So, you know, like I say, I made that decision on my own, and I may be the only judge, I don't know, maybe I'm the only judge in the whole state that holds those views, but it worked for me. So that's kind of the flip side to that. Well, I've always thought that elections were important. I understand the argument that contributing to a judge can cause some corruption, but, you know, from my perspective, you got honest judges with a lot of integrity. I just happen to be one that just refuses to take money from lawyers.
I agree with that. I clerked for a state court judge, and I also clerked for a federal judge, and both of them were extremely hardworking, and I thought very fair. But there have been judges, not to name names, there was a judge a while ago who was elected and made it to the newspapers for doing crazy things in court, and I remember having her speak in a number of things, and part of the problem is, I think, you know, I get calls, okay, most of you get calls from friends saying, which judges do I vote for, right? I don't even know half the judges myself. Mike, maybe you know them all, because you're in court more than I am, or maybe you do, but I don't know half the judges, and how many are there on the ballot? 50 each time, if you count them. And if the lawyers don't even know all the judges, other than trying to read the RJ poll, how's the general public going to vote for? But it's a gnarly question.
Yep.
Yeah. By the way, Mike and I, I'm glad to say, settled our case. We've had a good show the last week. We've always been friendly, but now we're not even opposite of
that. I think, and I think Judge Hafen is sort of the exception that proves the rule, that the perception is really bad. Because even though he doesn't take the money, the perception is that most people would assume he does. And unless they know that about you, they would. And that's where I think the problem lies, is this perception. And those situations that you find yourself in, mine was a little different in that a week after I got a really bad ruling, which I couldn't put my head around, I get an invitation from the law firm that I lost to for the kickoff campaign for the judge that ruled against me. So that, you know, that the appearance in that situation was just really bad. The other thing, and this I witnessed this, I was at a conference in which Judge Hardesty was speaking, and he publicly called out our judicial system and proclaimed inadequate judges, and didn't name names, of course, but that, you know, there were a number of judges in the room, and I thought he was being a little too candid at the moment. But when you have a justice of our Supreme Court that calls out the quality of our judging at the trial court level, that seems to indicate that there might be a problem with our system.
Yeah, you know, I guess that we obviously want judges who are full of integrity and fairness and work hard and follow the Constitution, the federal Constitution and the state Constitution. You know, one thing I ran into up in the legislature was a lot of people were, I would almost call, rabid on certain amendments, like the Second Amendment. I mean, I believe in the Second Amendment, but some people wanted to harm nursery schools, basically. And, but they forget the Seventh Amendment, which is just as important, you know, the right to jury trial. And so there's got to be a balance, and we've got to have lawyers and judges understand all those things. Thank you for your time.
Did you talk about the judges at all in this legislature that spend hundreds of thousands of dollars more than they actually raised, and then afterwards come to the attorneys for these debts, retirement parties, and those types of things?
We did pass one bill. I don't know if this answers your question, but and maybe Becky remembers better than I do, but we did pass one bill that says if you have, well, this is the opposite situation. To answer your question, no, we did not talk about that. But that does happen all the time, to retire the debt parties.
Right.
I get invited to them all the time, and probably all the time. There's also the other situation where an office holder will have a giant war chest and not spend it all. There's one Supreme Court justice right now, this is public record, who has millions of dollars in his war chest, and no one ever even runs against him. it's just kind of sitting there. It's almost like to scare off people. I don't know. So we did pass a law that says after you go out of office, and if it's been 2 years, then you have to get rid of your war chest. You have to, you know, either give it back or donate it to charity or something.
You have to donate to charity.
Yeah, isn't that what?
I don't know that
it
all goes to charity. You just have to liquidate.
Yeah, you have to liquidate.
So you can probably give to other candidates. You can give to a charity. You can give to education. You don't have all the exceptions off the top of my head, but you can't be appropriate.
That was part of the law also. We changed the law. Now, going forward, lobbyists can't even take legislators to lunch or dinner. It's really tightened up lobbying and what they have to report. Educational trips don't have to be reported.
Yes, I'm Randy Gilmer. I moved to Nevada about 2 years ago from Michigan, and we have direct elections of judges in Michigan. And I'd actually be curious to get your take on that, too, because I think Michigan is a little higher than 35 on that list that you were talking about. But one of the things that we've done for judges there to make sure that, or at least help with the impropriety issue, is that judges can only have a campaign committee for a certain period of time prior to their election, and it has to be liquidated immediately after. So while they're in office, they can't actually have it except in the year that they're running. I think it's either 18 months or 12 months prior to the election that they can be started. And then that way they can't have any money. Once it's done, they have the same thing. They have to give it either give it to charity or back to the contributors on a pro rata basis. That way there's not even any impropriety that they're giving the money to other partisan individuals. And that seems to have helped a bit, because it doesn't seem like they're in the constant state of raising money. There's also a limit as to how much they can raise from attorneys as opposed to the number. You can only solicit attorneys for a smaller number than you can the general public. So just a couple thoughts. I was wondering if that was ever thought about here.
I'm sure it's been thought about. The rules we have now are you're supposed to only take $5,000 from any person per election. So from one person you can take 10. Five for the primary, five for the general. If you don't win the primary, you've got to get the other five back. People get around it, though, sometimes by having all sorts of relatives donate.
Okay, thank you.